Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Monday night, April 6th. My name is Rob Doster. Once again, I am joined by Bobby Reagan, the host of the Fundamentally Sound Podcast, and we are here to talk through everything that's happened in college basketball over the course of the last week. And honestly, it really hasn't been all that much, Reagan. We're in that time of the year where everything is all about transfers and transfer lists and who's leaving and who's coming back and who's declaring for the NBA draft. So it's very much just waiting for rosters to shake out more than anything else. And to be frank, this is my least favorite time of the year when it comes to the college basketball calendar.
It's ironic you're saying that on National Championship Monday.
I don't care.
I care because, like, I love the NBA draft. I've always loved the NBA draft. So I care in terms of, like, who's declaring. But with the way that – and I completely support with how they do it, where you can test the water and come back. Like, I 100% am on board with that. So I want to get that straight now first. But until there's, like, a definitive list of who's coming back and who's going, I just don't care. Like, I don't care that somebody's testing the waters because – why not? Like, if you're, as long as you're not in terrible shape with terrible attitude, why not? Right? Like, it's gonna not hurt you as long as you come prepared. So I don't care unless some report comes out from testing the waters that, like, this person has a serious injury or that's gonna hold them back from either college basketball or the NBA draft. Which is, I don't think we've really had that yet. Like, the last thing was Isaiah Austin. That was before this process.
Well, Jordan Wara last year,
or he probably
would be gone. And honestly, like, that was one of the bigger, like, we always talked about how there were times when it felt like he was kind of checked out. And one of the things that I think was going on was that he kind of had this idea, like, I went through the process. I should be in the NBA. I see all the people that I might have been better than last year having success in the NBA, and I'm still in college. It felt a little bit like
there was
some stuff going on with that. So that's one of the dangers. Like, I fully believe that every player should go through and test the waters and let's see what's going on. But the risk of that is, like, Jordan Wara going in and coming back and not being completely bought in because he wants to be a pro, or someone like a Jared Harper saying, you know what, I may not be getting drafted, but I'm this far down the road, I might as well just stay because I don't want to go back to college.
That probably would happen regardless, though, like the Jared Harper situation, because we've seen that before in the previous life, before this and before one and done or you know, anything like that. So I'm like you. I just don't care. Like, it's almost like college classes until the final. Just let me know what I need to know to get my B going into that class, into that final. And that's what we're doing with, like, rosters. I don't care about transfers. I don't care. I care about transfers. I don't care, though, until, like, I don't need the Matt Harms has a list of 25 schools. Great. Of course he does. Every school should call him. I just don't care until there's a decision made.
Yeah, it's the guys like Borzello and Evan Daniels and Jeff Goodman and John Rothstein that are they basically just sit there and they're texting the whole day and they're working the phones and they're trying to get lists for these guys and trying to pass along the information. And that's the part of it that I'm just not like that. I can't make myself care about that. You know what I mean? Like, I can't fake it. I can't say, like, okay, I understand the work that those guys put in. I'm not trying to minimize that, believe me.
100%.
Yeah, I know. Like, I've seen Goodman working the phones before. Like, I know how he busts his ass when he does that. I just cannot muster up the strength or the energy, especially given everything that's going on right now, to give a fuck about getting a list for a guy that averaged 10 points a game at Columbia and is now flip-flopping between going to Duke, not going to Duke, and going to Duke. Right. I just don't care enough.
No, same. Like, just in the same thing, like, I'm finding it harder. When I was younger, I like to consider this a little bit of act of maturity. When I was younger, I would care about, like, the preseason, like, the way too early top 25 rankings and be like, well, how could you have this team up here? Like, that's just idiotic. Now I'm like, who gives a shit until the roster is filled? Like, because there's so many moving parts. And I get, listen, like, we're both in the same industry. We know what moves the needle. You rank something, one fan base is going to be pissed off. One fan base is going to be super happy. And there's going to be one, like, somewhat neutral party. Rankings move the needle. So I understand why every single person in the world does it. But I found myself just caring less and less, I guess, about even doing it, where I'm like, I don't even, people are like, well, what's your early top 25 for next year? I was like, I'll let you know when we see the rosters.
Yeah. Well, see, I like doing it beforehand because I enjoy, like, the reason why I love doing this is being like, okay, look at how these pieces fit. And this is how I think this team is going to end up playing out. So when I'm putting together these rankings, I'm like, man, you know what? Villanova is going to be so much fun to watch if Jeremiah Robinson Earl comes back. And so, like, that part, I don't really care. It's like it's ironing out, like, a list of schools for these guys that just don't, they're just not going to matter, you know? And, like, I get it, because the way that when you're in the news breaking industry, if you have information, you basically barter information.
Right.
So what happens is, if Borzello has a list of all these schools and where these kids are leaning and who's a favorite and blah, 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 then coaches are going to reach out to him to find out if they're in the mix, who to call, who's the guy, all that kind of stuff. Whereas then he can be like, if he needs something from one of them or he needs info about an injury, that's injury status or did a kid commit or whatever, then he can be like, hey, you know, what's going on with this? I've given you information. Now you got to help me out. Come on. You scratch my back, I scratch yours, kind of a deal. So I get how it works. That's just not the way that I want to cover the sport. That's just not. That's not why I got this business to be the information guy. Like, I respect like what Adam Schefter does. I don't want to be Adam Schefter.
No. I like being an analyst. I like talking about the game and about players, about what I see. Not about, well, you know, you're down to three schools. Who's the favorite? What percentage are you given? I get it. And it is a necessity, especially this day and age, for that information to be out there. People eat it up. And I don't want to minimize the guys who do that work. Like you, I even when I was like in college and a reporter and had to do that stuff, like call a recruit and be like, so are you still committing on, you know, March 25th? Like, I don't want to make this call. Can I just have some freshmen do this instead? Because I really don't feel like dealing with it. It just, I don't want to say it's boring to me, but it's just, I just love talking about the game way too much.
Yeah, a lot of guys get off on being able to have the scoops and break the news and do all that kind of stuff. Like, that's just not my cup of tea, not what I am interested in. Speaking of which, we might as well just segue into one of the topics we wanted to talk about today, stay or go decisions. You know, one of the interesting conversations to have is how some of these guys that will end up declaring for the NBA draft and coming back to school, like what kind of impact they will have on their next teams. And the reason I bring this up is because Scotty Lewis, a former top 10 recruit, McDonald's All-American, and a guy that entered the season as a potential top 10 pick, announced today that he is going to be coming back to Florida for another year. And like, I read the release whatever PR guy reviewed that and wrote that for him made it sound really good, because it basically was like, yeah, you know what? I got to get better. I haven't been good enough. I'll see you back and try to improve. And honestly, I think he might end up being like the best player and the best prospect to end up coming back to school. Cause he's a guy that I still believe legitimately has like a lottery talent. He's that athletic and that good defensively. But him coming back to school, I'm not going to say it has a huge impact on Florida. Cause I'm done buying in on Florida.
Yeah. No, Florida sticks.
that ship has sailed. Like, we'll be surprised by them now. They're now the sleeper.
Florida could finish 40.
Once you become the trendy team and then you shit the bed, you're the sleeper. You have at least a 3-year window before you're anything other than a sleeper.
I would say Florida can finish 40-0, and I'd be like, nah, they stink. Like, I'm out on Florida. I don't trust them.
Yeah. Oh man. All right. So the biggest stay or go decisions for you. Give me your top three or four of the guys that you're most most intrigued on seeing?
I still throw Emmanuel Quickley in there with Hagans and Maxey, obviously not surprising leaving. I think Emmanuel Quickley, we talked about it before at length, so I don't need to go in depth on what he brings back to Kentucky and the importance of that, but I'm going to throw Emmanuel Quickley in there. I think that Jeremiah Robinson Earl is, in this top three, going to Villanova. And
so you haven't mentioned my first two yet. And the two biggest
things. I thought JRE was your first, was your number one.
No, he's up there, but the reason why he's not number one for me is I think the other two are, let me put it like this. I think that Jeremiah Robinson Earl makes Villanova the national title favorite. Without him, I think they're probably more like a top five, top six, top eight kind of a team. Whereas if Malachi Flynn comes back to San Diego State, then they're probably, in my mind, a top 10 team. And without Malachi
you're a lot
Flynn,
higher on them.
I don't think San Diego State is a top 10 team. I mean, look, they lose KJ Fagan, like great glue guy, really good defender, fits well next to Malachi Flynn, but he's basically just a role player. They lose him, and then they lose Yanni Wetzel. And Yanni Wetzel is good, but he also started the season as the backup center to Nathan Mensah. Nathan Mensah is coming back and is going to be healthy.
But can Mensah stay healthy, though, is a question, I think.
He might not be able to, but right. There still is another Mensah on that roster, and I would not be surprised to see if they're in the mix for some sides with some of these grad transfers and transfers that are kind of moving around. But either way, I think that there is enough there where if they do have Malachi Flynn, who, like, look, he was a second-team All-American for me. I think he ends up coming back
first team.
Preseason first-team All-American. You put him on the floor, and the way that Brian Dutcher can build an offense around him, he is a guy that I think, like, first-team All-American on a team that has a Matt Mitchell, on a team that still has Jordan Shackle coming back on, and that is coached by Brian Dutcher. To me, that is a top 10. Maybe you could say they're top 15 or so, but they're very much in the mix for being like a top four seed with Malachi Flynn there. Without him, I would not feel comfortable locking them into the NCAA.
I get that, but for me, the decisions of going from back end top 10 to top three in the country, national title favorite, is more important than a top 40 to a top 20 team.
Fair enough. And the other guy on my list.
My third one would be pick your choice of one of the Creighton guards, Tyshawn Alexander or Marcus Zagorowski.
Yeah, like, I mean, both of them are very important in that decision-making process and in how the season ends up playing out. For me, number two is Luka Garza.
Yeah.
And that might be pushing it simply because, like, you can make the argument that he doesn't really have a decision to make. Like, I'm not convinced that he's
not an NBA player. I mean, he might end up getting a cup of coffee in the NBA, but he's not a top 60 player and like top 60 prospect for this year's draft.
Yeah. All right. Give me two other guys on your list that you that might be sleepers.
Sleepers.
Low-key important.
Oh, who would we say here?
You want mine? Yeah, so I think Xavier Tillman is widely underrated in terms of how important he will be to Michigan State next season. If he comes back along those same lines, I think Yves Pons at Tennessee is the difference between, he's the difference between the Vols being like a top 10 to top 15 team and being someone that's really dangerous, but probably won't be very good defensively. And the other one that I think is really important that hasn't gotten enough attention or conversation yet is Jay Scrubb.
You took mine. You said you were listening too. I had Scrubb. No, Scrubb is, that's definitely an important one.
One that I think is very, very important. Actually, two more that I think are very important.
Are we going to get the Butler guys in there?
Jared Butler?
I'm sorry, the Baylor guys? Yeah, Butler and Macy Oteague.
I think Butler is more important than Macy Oteague because I don't think the only reason Macy Oteague would go pro is because he's finished his 4 years in college. Like, I don't think that he's a guy that has a chance to get drafted. Jared Butler might get drafted.
Do we have to say Cole Anthony just because he technically hasn't signed with an agent?
He's going pro.
I know. I'm just saying. You know who's one? Isaiah Livers.
Yep. I agree with that one.
Because he's.
But I think he's going to end up coming back because they had the kid transfer out today.
The Julius transferred out today. Yeah.
Yeah.
for opening up a roster spot. If they didn't think that he was coming back, then I don't know if DeJulius would be transferring. The only other one that I have listed that I think is really influential is Jalen Suggs at Gonzaga.
Yeah.
And he's not going to enter the NBA draft, obviously, but he has to decide whether or not he's going to go play at Gonzaga as a freshman or do the whole one-and-done thing in Australia like RJ Hampton and LaMelo Ball did.
Are we under the assumption that Jamias Ramsey is just 100% for sure gone? Because we didn't list him. I was working under the assumption that he's gone.
I would assume that he's gone.
Right. I'm just saying why we didn't list him.
Modus operandi.
Yeah, because he's a name that people would say, well, why didn't you say him? That's why I wanted to just bring that up.
I had a guy ask me why I didn't say Jalen Smith when I put out this list.
I think Smith played his – you know what? If you asked me before the season, I would have said Smith is coming back. He's put himself into I wouldn't come back if I were him.
He might be a top 20 pick, dude. He might be a top 20 pick.
He played himself into a first-round pick, just a matter of where. I wouldn't come back if I were him.
Yeah, I wouldn't come back either. So – let's just leave it at that. I don't really have anything else to add there. Let's talk about the scheme, because I think the scheme is, for people that don't know, the scheme is the documentary of Christian Dawkins and the FBI investigation into college basketball corruption. I have a lot of thoughts about how this thing ended up playing out. I think I watched it probably a month ago. Like, I had a screener, access to a screener, so I didn't rewatch it when everybody watched it live. I think it was last Tuesday.
So
6 days ago. So I did not watch it then when it came out. I watched it back in probably 3 weeks before that. So I don't know. I'm curious how you feel about it, because I've had plenty of time to watch it and think about it and write a column about it and react to it. So what did you think when you finally saw the scheme, the Christian Dawkins documentary?
I don't know. Like, I knew the entire story. So it wasn't – it was interesting to see from, I guess, like the undercover agent camera angle, just because you don't typically get to see things like that, especially when you're talking about college basketball. So seeing that, I guess, was interesting or intriguing, but didn't tell me anything new. I didn't learn anything. My thought, like, nothing changed about what I thought about this whole investigation and how it's a kind of just a waste of time. And it's just, I don't care. I don't care if people are getting money to play college basketball. College football, too. Like, this is happening. It's not a college basketball. It's not limited to college basketball. It's not limited to these few schools. It is something that's happened 4 years across multiple sports. It's just somehow now perceived as a college basketball problem, which it's not. And that always aggravates me. I don't know, man. I just didn't care. Like, I watched it, kind of fell asleep, darn it. It was too long. It shouldn't have been 2 hours.
I thought that – so my reaction to it was that if you had paid attention to the story and you had followed along with the trials and you had been reading the documents that were released by the FBI at the time – and kind of stayed on top of it like you would if you're a college basketball writer. None of these stuff in there really was surprising whatsoever. I mean, we knew all of the information. It was kind of eye-opening to actually hear the wiretaps, but we knew about all the quotes.
We had read them before.
The most incendiary things that were said was all like kind of secondhand stuff. And again, we knew all of that. Sean Miller said that that Will Wade has huge balls. Christian Dawkins called Will Wade a gangster. We knew all of that stuff. None of the info, like, we still don't have a wiretap of DeAndre Ayton being discussed for a $100,000 payment by Sean Miller. So that was probably like the most newsworthy thing that came out of the entire documentary. For me, my biggest takeaway was, my assumption with Christian Dawkins, like, I had never met him, but I have spoken to a lot of people that had met him, that had spoken with him, that had dealt with him. And I was kind of anticipating, like, the way that he's always been, like, described is just like the slapdick, right? This guy that was kind of a hanger-on, this guy who was trying to, like, weasel his way into the business because of his connections to players. And, like, that's not the way that he came off at all.
No.
Like, he came off as really intelligent and kind of had this like dry humor. And he really struck me as like a guy that I would enjoy talking with because he was a
great storyteller.
Great storyteller, smart. You know he's connected, and it's very easy to watch him in these interviews where he's like, you could tell that you can understand why he had such a skill in being able to connect with people and to network with people and to get people to trust him and to get people to like him, because like he seemed like a very likable guy, like someone I would want to hang out and get a beer with him. Like if we were in Vegas, I would say, yeah, take that wad of cash the FBI gave you and let's go hit the strip club and have a good night. Right. Like that's the kind of guy, like that's the kind of guy he kind of appeared to be. So it was very easy to see how he would be able to network with people the way that he was able to network with them. Now, the thing that you have to keep in mind when you watch this documentary is that Christian Dawkins, like this was basically his defense.
Right.
And he got paid for this. I don't know exactly how much. I've heard numbers that weren't quite six figures is the number that's kind of like the basically like what you hear when you talk to people about how much he got paid for the documentary. It's not quite six figures, but it's up there and it's a pretty good amount of money. And it's good seed money to be able to start whatever he's now a record producer or something like that. So it's important to remember that he got paid for this. And it's also important to remember that this is more or less the defense that he was not allowed to present at trial. Like if you remember, he basically like wanted to say that it's stupid that this is a crime and NCAA rules are bullshit and there's no victim here. And the judge was basically like, you can't argue that a crime hasn't been committed. Like that's not a defense. Like what he wanted to argue in his defense was not a defense. And this was more or less what he wanted to present when he was at trial and say about himself. And it came across true. Like I agree with everything that he said in that.
Yeah. I mean, Wetzel had the statement or the sentence that sticks out the most to me about this whole thing, where it was not word for word, but it was along these lines of, can you really be defrauded when you're receiving $165 million and the best basketball players you can get?
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing about this is like, we've been making that argument for years.
Yeah.
None of the stuff that came out in here is different than what we've been saying for years, but it kind of presented itself to maybe a new audience or people that aren't college basketball aficionados or diehards that pay attention to this. But I did think that it was kind of relevant that like we really only heard three voices through the entire documentary. It was Christian Dawkins, his lawyer, Steve Haney, and Dan Wetzel, the columnist for Yahoo. Like his parents were involved early on, but like Sean Miller didn't talk.
Will Wade didn't talk.
And we didn't really hear anything else from all that many people. Like, I can't even think off the top of my head. Like, did anybody else even speak?
Fred VanVleet.
Oh, yeah. Fred. Like, how random is that, Fred VanVleet? And that's another thing that really stood out to me. Like, I don't know about you, but Dawkins came off as believable in everything that he said.
Yeah.
And part of the reason that he came off believable is, like, he just kind of had this, like, aloofness. This, like, yeah, like, what? Like, that's what happened. Like, what do you want me to say? And it didn't seem like he was making a lot of this stuff up. Like the way that he reacted in a lot of these situations and a lot of these conversations did not come off like he was trying to lie and trying to sell something. And I'm sure part of that is like when you're good at networking, you're good at putting on a front for people and selling people on stuff. So I'm sure that was part of it, but he did not come off in this documentary like he was a liar. And I don't believe that he really lied about all that much.
Yeah, no, I think it was, and maybe it's just because my belief of how the NCAA and the amateurism rules bullshit, where I was just like, yeah, like I believe them because this is my belief of the situation as well. You know, like it's easy to skew towards your own belief system in anything, but especially like I feel strongly about amateurism being a sham. And so anything, like he could have done that documentary naked screaming, I paid these players. I'd be like, you know what? That's my guy. I believe him because I stand on the same side as him on the topic.
Yeah, it's part of what I think was so impactful about it, at least for me. Well, maybe impactful is the wrong word, but part of what I think stood out the most was how like he made the FBI look so foolish. And look, you have to remember that this is coming from Christian Dawkins' side and it's Christian Dawkins' defense, but there are actual wiretap recordings of him that they played where he was basically like, this is so stupid. Like, why are you trying to pay the coaches?
Yeah.
He was trying to talk Jeff D'Angelo, who was the undercover FBI agent.
Is he the worst FBI agent of all time?
I mean, he's got to be up there.
I think we could be FBI agents. Like, the dude liked to gamble. He rambled on. Like, it's me and you on a Saturday night when we're together.
But, I mean, look, you want to know what it legitimately made me think? Like, we kind of know what's going on. We're not in the know. We're not involved. We're not out there paying players. But we kind of understand how this works. So when we were watching this, we were like, I don't know if this goes for you two, Riggs, but my reaction was like, how is the FBI so clueless about what's going on
here? I know. Like, do one hour of research and you could have figured out a better strategy to attack this undercover.
Yes, but here's the thing. They had to find a way to make it be a crime. And if you're bribing the coaches who are paid by the state, then that makes it a crime. But the thing that really stood out to me was Christian Dawkins having these conversations. Like, if you want to make this work, if you want to actually be able to have these players sign with your company, you cannot go to the coaches because coaches do not want them to go pro.
Yeah.
They want them to come back unless I think this was a direct quote. I don't have the actual quote written down, but Dawkins was basically like, unless you're Kentucky, when you have five more pros coming in right after them, the coaches don't want this guy to leave.
Yeah, that was a quote.
If you are going out there and paying the coaches, like, that's not the best way to do this. There are ways to do this that don't involve things as dumb as paying the coaches. And then there's other wiretaps where he's talking to the coaches. He's like, look, just take the money. Like, I'm going to use this seed money for a business. Like, I'll cut you your check. We'll go out and have a good time. But let me take the money out of there. And, like, we'll go spend this. And that's basically what happened. Like, you can see it on the undercover videos where Christian Dawkins is the one that takes the money out of there because he's like, we're just going to fuck over the FBI. Like, we'll do this the way that we want to do this, but I just need you to help me get that money out of there. I even had, while it was on, I had one coach call me up and be like, and this is exactly what he said to me. He's like, I am so glad that I did not know Christian Dawkins because if I did, I would be in jail right now.
Yeah. This
is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. How is the FBI so dumb? And he was like, all right, look, I got to go because I got to go finish watching this documentary. But that's what the coaching reaction was. It was like, why not? And in hindsight, I think that, like, Christian Dawkins probably is sitting there like, man, I really fucked up. Like, I knew there was something wrong. I knew that this guy was like shelling out too much money. And I knew that this was something that was extremely dumb. Why didn't I stop? Why didn't I do literally anything else other than take their money? But then again, like, he's trying to start a business and you need seed money to start a business. So if the FBI or if this guy is willing to just give it to you, then why wouldn't you take it? Because at the end of the day, the guy, if you're Christian Dawkins and you're thinking like, okay, this guy's an idiot, but he doesn't care how I spend this money as long as I get him the players and deliver the players, right? So that's got to be what he was thinking, which it just – I don't know. To a point, I do kind of feel bad for him.
I was shocked about how many former, like, relatively big-name college basketball players, some now coaches, I saw tweeting out or texting, like, wow, this is wild. I'm like, is it? Like, this is just everything we knew. Like, the only thing that's wild is, like you said about the coach that you talked to, of, well, that really could have been 98% of the coaching population who just wanted to have a good time. Like,
I think that's why they're saying it's wild because, like, of how
I guess because it's not wild. Like, it's not a wild story. Like, this is, it's a very common story and a story that we've heard for what, 4 years now, 3 years, however long it's been.
Here's the thing that I like. I think my biggest takeaway. Well, there were two of like my biggest takeaways. The first one is like, how the fuck is Marty Blazer not in prison?
Yeah, that dude sucks.
That guy is the scumbag. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've watched Tiger King yet, but how everybody else is getting in trouble, but like Jeff Lowe is still out here. That fat guy that was riding on the Sea-Doo, like, he's still out there.
I don't understand.
Guys that seem like the actual bad guys didn't get hit.
I know.
Marty Blazer's a bad person. He stole millions of dollars. The wildest thing is he stole millions of dollars to invest in movies. One of the movies he invested in had Michael Clark Duncan, the big black guy from Green Mile, Misha Barton, and Devin Sawa.
Three big names.
three big names. I can't remember the name of the movie. I'll regret that I don't know it right now. But yeah, those guys were in a movie. Like, that's what he stole money from his clients to invest in to try to get rich. That guy's not. He didn't do a day in jail. But Christian Dawkins, who was giving money to coaches and giving money to gave $100,000 to set up a $100,000 deal for Brian Bowen, he's going to go do 18 months or whatever it is. Book Richardson's got to go do 3 months in prison. It's the dumbest thing in the world.
Wasn't Marty like facing 63 months in prison and he got like 2 months probation?
Well, yeah, because like the thing is he flipped. He got caught up by the SEC stealing money from his clients, millions and millions of dollars. Like, he was a financial advisor and actually stole money from people. And the way that he got off was by giving Christian Dawkins to the FBI, which is just so ridiculous. And it proves how clueless the FBI was in this investigation. So the funniest part to me is now, if you go back and you watch that press conference where the guy's like, I can't remember his name.
We have your game plan.
We have your playbook. No, motherfucker, you have the wrong playbook. Because we're trying to pay the coaches. Like, that's the funniest thing. Like, Christian Dawkins was out there trying to tell him what the actual playbook was. And Jeff D'Angelo is out here like, no, we don't want to do that. Introduce me to Sean Miller. Let me come into the practice and hang out with Sean Miller.
It's just so dumb. It's so dumb.
The whole trial itself and the charges and the fact that these people got in trouble, like, it made me really, really mad and really frustrated and really angry at the time. And watching this documentary and talking about it just makes me angry and frustrated and mad all over again. So I just, I think we need to move on, because that's all I got to say about the scheme. Before we get into the other stuff that we have to talk about, including boycott of Final Four open practices.
Yeah.
Riggs, it's the craft beer cast, bro. And you haven't told me what you're drinking yet.
It's the craft beer quarantine.
Craft beer quarantine.
I switch it up. I'm typically a loyal guy, as evidence of just staying on this podcast for 8 months now. I went with Moorline. It's the oldest brewery in Cincinnati. They're big hazy IPA. My wife picked up a six pack of that when she was at the store last. So it is what I have. It's a good one. It's decent. It's like their house. It's just like their house IPA, but it's a hazy version.
So I am drinking the Stone FML.
Which is not right.
Yeah, but it's actually, it's not what you think FML is. It's Fear Movie Lines. It's another DIPA. I love the DIPAs. It's Tall Boy, 8.5%. And it's the perfect balance of flavorful and just like overwhelming hops that just punch you in the face. So it's got that perfect kind of West Coast IPA crispness. It's so strong and there's so much hop in there. And it's the kind of thing where it's like you take a sip and you just feel it on your tongue for the next 10 minutes. But it's absolutely one of my, it might actually be my favorite beer by Stone. And if you know me, you know how much I love Stone and that brewery and what they put out. So that should tell you all you need to know about what I am drinking at the moment. 8.5% Tall Boy DIPA. So by the end of this podcast, it could get a little interesting. All our podcasts have gotten interesting by
now. I know. So we just start rambling and then we get both deep into the woods on something and just start blurting out whatever's on our mind.
Which is why the ending of this one is going to be so good when we have a rant draft. But before we do that, so Duncan Robinson came out today and said to Brendan Quinn of The Athletic and Nick Baumgartner as well on their podcast, he talked about how they had a plan in place in 2018 to boycott the open practices at the Final Four. And if you've never been to a Final Four, I'll set the stage for you. What happens on the Friday before the actual Final Four games is they have an open practice where you can pay to come in and watch. Like, it's basically just a shooter on. Every team will go and have their own practice elsewhere, but it's basically just a chance for the fans to come in for 45 minutes and watch the players that they've been supporting all season long run around, shoot a bunch of threes, have a bunch of dunks. Alumni can get in there. You can get up close. You get a picture in the stadium without having to actually like pay for a ticket to the Final Four itself. So you can Instagram that shit.
Tom Izzo did a gender reveal at it last year.
Yes. So there's all this wild stuff that you can get done and all this fun you can have, but it has nothing to do with the actual players. It's all about the fans. It's all about the NCAA. It's a money-making revenue stream for them. And it also like it kind of gets bookended by media availability that we get on Fridays. And like that, honestly, like for fans that don't understand how the the process of this kind of works. Like, they open up the locker room. The way that you get great stories from the Final Four is on Thursday and Friday, they open up the locker rooms for probably like 40 to 45 minutes for each team. And you can kind of get in there. You talk to who you need to talk to. You actually get to face to face with people. You can have a conversation with an assistant coach, get a tip on a story or something, actually go and ask these kids and these players face to face, have a conversation with them. And it kind of sets the stage for the best writing that you can do and the best storytelling that you can do over the course of the entire event. And it's so valuable to be able to get in there and be able to tell these stories. But for the players themselves, like, I remember specifically having a conversation with Justin Jackson at the 2016 Final Four. And I was like, "So are you happy to see us again?" And he's like, "I wish I could be on, or I wish I could say I could, but like, I spend more time with you than I do with my family here at this event. So I'm ready for it to be done." I was like, "Oh shit."
not what you typically want to hear from like a Final Four starter.
Yeah, I was like, "Tell me how you really feel, Justin." But Duncan Robinson's idea was, and apparently, like, he says that he was able to reach out to players on every single one of the Final Four teams in 2018, and he was basically like, "We were going to boycott the open practices on Friday," which, like, I don't know. Is that a story? Like, what do you think would happen if he actually did it?
I remember that rumor circulating back in San Antonio, because that was my first Final Four. And I remember there was, like, something, like, there was some buzz that the players were going to do something. I think it would have drawn a storyline through Saturday's games before everyone starts talking about the championship. But the reason I think it was big there is it was the perfect, near perfect mix of the Final Four. You had Michigan, who's one of the richest athletic departments in the country. You had Kansas, who is as blue blood gets in basketball. You had Villanova, 2 years removed from a national title. And you had Loyola, a mid-major. If a mid-major jumps in with them and boycotts this open practice, I think that starts drawing more attention than as opposed to if it's Kentucky, Kansas, North Carolina, Duke, where it's like, well, of course they are. They're the four biggest names in college basketball. When you kind of have this mix of a football, like a rich football school, a basketball blue blood, this now dominant kind of Big East power, and a mid-major, I think that would have been a storyline and been talked about more seriously because of that mix. I think people would have laughed at it, like, well, if they really cared, they would have boycotted the games. Who cares about an open practice? It's still money that's going to end up costing the NCAA, and it does. Like, it just shows the entire thing. Like, again, I said it before, it's a sham. Like, it's a quick moneymaker, like you said too, where, you know, you pay $20. Well, guess what? Like, especially when you're talking about Kansas and Michigan and Villanova that have these massive fan bases, they're going to come damn near sell the place out for an open practice. That money adds up. And it's like, yeah, just make it a 50-50 split. Give the players 50% because that's who they're there to see. You know, it's like, I just don't, like, that's a solution to where, hey, you can be rewarded for a bonus for making the Final Four. And if you sell tickets because people are coming to watch you, you get some money too. Like, it's just another way to set up some sort of solution for this name, image, likeness battle that's going to go on for years and years and years. I think it was interesting though, because I don't know how much it would have done, but I think it would have put a dent at least into some stories.
It absolutely would have been like a massive story. Like, part of the reason why Duncan Robinson said that he didn't do that, for people that don't know, Duncan Robinson is like the transfer from Division III Williams that ended up playing 4 years at, well, 3 years at Michigan, 4 years, including his redshirt year, and now is a starter with the Miami Heat. And he said part of the reason they didn't do this is because they thought that it might end up getting away from them. And they were kind of worried about how one bad soundbite from a player involved in a locker room would have completely torpedoed what their message was supposed to be.
Yeah. Didn't want it to be just John Beilein having to deal with it. He wanted it to be everything.
Yeah. And like, it wouldn't have worked unless it was everybody
right
being involved, everyone at the Final Four. And they were a little bit worried about having everyone on the same page. They were also worried about like having something get blown out of proportion and the message getting like wires getting crossed because they didn't have enough time planning it, but he was also like, he was worried about this being a story that could kind of get away from them. Right. And it certainly is the kind of thing that can completely like spiral out of control. Like there, I guarantee that if they ended up as all four teams boycotted the open practice, especially if they boycotted the media session as well, which sounds like they might have been doing.
Yeah.
Then like it would have become a thing. Like the entire story leading up to this would have been, are they actually going to play the games? Right. Are they going to boycott the actual Final Four itself? And that's not something you want to deal with heading into the biggest game that you're probably ever going to play as a college basketball player. And now, I can totally understand why they wouldn't want to deal with that.
And I can understand why there's hesitation, like to get 100% on board across four teams. Like, although the image of just Sister Jean sitting in that gym by herself with like fans around.
Sister Jean was in that. Look, I attended the Sister Jean press conference.
I was so out on Sister Jean.
It was, I understand why it was such a huge story and like I get it, but the fact that the biggest press conference I've ever seen at a Final Four was for Sister Jean is just absolutely bonkers.
It's
absolutely bonkers.
I'm out on Sister Jean. I was so out on Sister Jean.
We talked about this at the on some of the Run It Back podcasts, and every year at the Final Four, there just becomes a story that gets picked up on,
beaten to the ground.
Yeah, it gets picked up on by like the media that's not there to cover the actual game, like it, but the guys that aren't us, by just the national whatever media, by like CNN and MSNBC and all these other companies,
like the number two reporter for like the main sites that are there, where you have one that is there for the game and one that is there to find the abstract story.
Yeah, but it just kind of get like it goes viral, it gets picked up by all this stuff. Everyone starts talking about it. It was like Nate Britt and Chris Jenkins being like brothers basically and living together. It was William Avery and Ricky Moore being on the same high school basketball team and knowing each other since they were 5 years old and 7 years old. It was Tony Bennett and Virginia and like getting to the Final Four the year after they lost to a 16, like all of those specific storylines.
Bennett couldn't attend the games because he got too nervous and things like that.
Yeah. It's like all that's like, it just gets completely beaten into the ground because everyone's looking for stuff that people want to pay attention to. And it's like the human interest stuff like that, that just gets entirely blown out of proportion and becomes a huge thing and gets this becomes a monster of its own. So I understand why Sister Jean got to the point that it did, but man, Sister Jean, I just was not, I couldn't muster up the energy to care about the Sister Jean. And I specifically remember like my editor, Tess Quinlan, Mike Miller, like the guys that are my bosses are, I love them. They're very open in what they allow me to do and they don't really have any oversight. They just kind of let me run my own shop. But also like they were like, we need stories on Sister Jean because the traffic on like the Google search results for this are just absolutely baffling. Like you have to do something on Sister Jean. I'm like, okay, fine. I guess since you signed my paychecks, then I'll have to do what you say. But I'm not going to be happy about it.
But I do wonder what the storyline would have been or how it would have been perceived if, like I said, I thought those four that made up that Final Four were the perfect fit for this storyline of boycotting the open practice to make it a bigger deal. I do wonder like what would have happened if it was. Like, what would have been the right, like, what's the perfect mix? What's the worst mix for this boycott to happen and to actually make it a story?
I mean, I don't know what the perfect mix would be, but I do think that boycotting the open practices is the perfect way to actually go about doing this because you get your point across. It becomes a major story. Like, first and foremost, you have to be organized and you have to make sure that, like, all the players in the locker rooms are able to part like to toe the party line. And I don't know if that's necessarily feasible or possible, but you have to be very organized when you do this. Especially like, cause you don't know you're going to be in the Final Four until 4 days before the Final Four and getting everybody on the same page when they're 18 to 22 years old. And some of them maybe aren't the brightest players in the history of the world. So getting everybody on the same page seems like a really tall task, but if you're going to do it, like, you can get your point across by boycotting the open practices. It becomes like a major national story for 24 hours. Then the games start, you show up to play and you still get to play in the Final Four.
Yeah. That's a win. Like
that's the win. All right. So what we're going to do, one of the things that we want to try to figure out how to do is be able to do like a mock draft kind of a deal since it's mock draft season. And we're going to have drafts of things that we decide on Tuesdays. This is kind of like a work in progress. So if it comes off as really bad, just let us know in the reviews. Yeah. And tell us to never do it again. But what we're going to do is draft our favorite rants from college basketball coaches over the course of the years. We're each going to have five because if we put together a top five, like we would have probably four of the same top five, right?
Well, without a doubt.
So we have to do a draft to be able to get more out there and to talk about more different things and not just have the same Notre Dame back type stuff on there. So I'm going to let you decide what you want. You either get the first pick or the second and third pick, and then we'll just alternate for there. You get 1, 4, and 6. You get 1, 4, 6, 8, 10, or 2, 3, 5, 7, 9. Does that make sense?
Why, if we're doing a snake, why wouldn't I have?
Because it just ends up being two picks and two picks and two picks, so it's just going back and forth. Is it's easier to do it that way?
I'll take the first pick.
Go ahead.
I'm taking the dominant team. I'm taking 2012 Kentucky. I'm taking 2018 Nova. It's John Calipari. It's John Chaney. It's I'ma kill you. It starts with I'ma kill you, and then de-escalates down to one of my players is gonna kick one of your players' ass. It's the best. It's young John Calipari at UMass after a game. It's John Chaney, the staple at Temple forever. Before even like Goongate came out with Temple and John Chaney, which makes that line of I'm going to get a player to kick one of your players' asses even funnier to me. It's just the best. Like it's the no doubt number one pick.
Yeah. My favorite part about that is after everything gets settled down, after John Chaney bum rushes John Calipari's press conference. And like the best part is like, oh yeah, you know what? I heard this when I was at West Virginia. I'm going to kick your ass. When I see you, I'm going to kick your ass. But the very best part is at the very end, like John Calipari just ends it. He just kind of shakes his head. He's like, no, some things never change.
And I think a lot of people think like Calipari's from like always been like a white collar guy. He's from like a blue collar Pittsburgh suburb with his family being like coal miners. Like he is not from what he's perceived to be now. And back in the day, like he's probably what 30, mid 30s in that at most.
Something like that. But it was one, he looks very thin. And two, like his reaction at the end is just
laughing at you. It's almost like a son pissing off like his uncle. We're like, it's not his dad where he can just kind of brush it off. It's his uncle where the uncle like reacts how he wants him to. And the young asshole kid just starts laughing at Thanksgiving dinner again.
Yeah. All right. So I get two picks now. And I think, you know, both of mine are going to end up being.
It's my 2 and 3.
Yeah. So my second favorite rant that a coach has ever gone on was, actually it's my favorite. It's Jim Calhoun talking about Ryan Gomes.
He's like, it's the most quotable.
You want me to say I fucked up? I fucked up. I took Caron Butler and Emeka Okafor. They're not bad. When I saw him, he was 6'5", 260 pounds.
I can't take everyone.
They're not bad. I love the Boston accent that comes out in there. It's perfect. It's quintessential Jim Calhoun.
It is the most quotable. It's the most quote outside of maybe like two to three announcer calls. It's probably the most quotable thing in college basketball history.
You want me to say I fucked up? I fucked up.
Because you can use it into anything. Like anytime, you like if you say one thing or the other, you're like, I took Emeka Okafor and Caron Butler. They're not bad. You can use Caron it in Butler anything.
And Emeka Okafor. My favorite part about that is every single syllable he says in Caron Butler and Emeka Okafor ends in ah. Caron Butler and Emeka Okafor.
I miss Jim Calhoun calling games. I
love him so much.
Just to guess what he said half the time. Like Twitter, when he would call a game and be like, what is Jim Calhoun saying? I would just be like, this is awesome.
All right. And so number two on my list is obviously Notre Dame back. For people that don't know, there was a – some reporter came to a press conference, I think it was after like a South Florida game, and was asking about being the highest paid highest paid person in the state, public official in the state of Connecticut, and was like, and Jim Calhoun cuts off his question, is like, not a dime back.
Yeah.
Not a dime back. He's like, would you please? We, quite frankly, we make $12 million for this university. We make $12 million for this university. Oh, it's just the best.
It's a good one. It's a good one. It's just like, that's Pete Calhoun too.
Yeah, he's like, fuck you. I know. I'm not giving my money back. No, the absolute best part about that rant is he's like, oh no, I make a lot more than that.
It's so good. It's so good.
Oh man, I love Jim Calhoun. All right, yeah, your next pick.
This is tough. I'm debating some here. I'm gonna go with Barry Hinson, Southern Illinois. After Murray State, he starts with, what did he say? My backcourt guys were 2 for 11. My wife could go better for 2 for 11 because she would pump fake.
The best part about that is like, you know how you see in cartoons or like on TV shows, whenever someone like from the South gets real mad, They say things, but they say it twice, and the second time they say it so much louder. Yep. If you go back and watch it, Barry Hinson goes, they had six turnovers. They must think it's a tax credit. They shot 2 for 11 from the floor. My wife, yeah, scored more than 2 buckets on 11 shots because she would know to pump fake.
He says the tax credit line. Then he gets into, I saw them turning it over a bunch of times. I saw one of them say Merry Christmas and just handed them the ball. And then he goes, I don't know about you guys, but there was a sniper in the gym. There was a sniper in the gym. Do you see how many times my guy fell? There's a sniper in the gym.
He said, I've been telling my wife this for years. Yeah. Size doesn't matter.
It's so good. And Barry Hinson, not only like, this is an off topic rant. Did you ever see his, you can't forget about the valley. I'll send it. It's like a commercial and it's so good. It's Barry Hinson again.
Because he's got the perfect combination of whiny, raspy voice and like
Southern drawl.
It's incredible. My wife could score more than 2 buckets on 11 shots. Oh, what a legend. What a legend. All right. So my next one. You probably wouldn't pick this one and wouldn't guess that I'm about to go with it, but I'm taking Taurean Prince. I know he's not a coach, but his rebound rant.
Oh, well, okay. Yeah. I didn't know we were doing that.
Well, look, I decided to change the rules on the fly because that is absolutely the best thing that has ever been said.
Yeah, it's such a good answer.
So the best part about it is, like Yale was a great rebounding team and they were in the Ivy League, and Baylor's obviously in the Big 12 and they were really good rebounding too. But a reporter asked Taurean Prince after Baylor as a 5 seed got upset by Yale in the first round of the NCAA tournament, why you can't rebound. And he's like, you know, when the ball comes off the rim and you go and you grab it, that's considered a rebound. They got more of those.
All right. So my pick,
your pick.
Because, all right, we'll each get one player interview or press conference.
That's fine.
Because you took Taurean Prince, and you took the wrong player press conference. By far, the best player press conference. Boston College, Dennis Clifford, when he loses in the ACC tournament, and BC finishes like 0-4 in the ACC. And they ask him what his favorite memory is going to be from playing college basketball. And he says his favorite memory is going out to eat the Chipotle. It's the saddest, best post. Like, it just summed up. And he's like, he hangs his head. He's a senior that just played his last game. Boston College flat out sucked. And it's just so perfect that he said going out to eat.
Yeah, well, I think the point that he was trying to make is like the memories that he had off the court with his teammates.
Sure, but that's not what he said.
He hangs his head and he starts crying. He says, going out to eat through tears. Oh, that's a very good one.
So that's my third one.
All right, so my next one is D'Antoni's rant about analytics.
Yep.
Which is just, it's perfect. I might just plug in that audio and play it because it's just, it's so great. You can't
replicate a D'Antoni sound.
No, you can't. But like, So someone asks him why, like Marshall, for people that don't know, like all they do is fire up threes. And someone after a press conference was like, how do you ever think about getting the ball inside, like taking the ball inside a little more? And D'Antoni, with his like t-shirt under a blazer and his Coke bottle glasses, is just like, you're old school, ain't you? You're old school. And then he goes to like in this West Virginia draw, starts talking about how like the best shot you can get is the corner three, and then it's every other three. And then he's explaining it in like points per possession terms. And then like everyone starts laughing. And the guy like starts asking another question. He's like, I ain't finished my dang old analytics story yet. You got to go to bed or something. It's just like, it's absolutely perfect. For people that don't know, Dan D'Antoni is Mike D'Antoni's brother. Mike, yep. D'Antoni, head coach of the Houston Rockets. So, I love that one so much. And it's all because Dan D'Antoni is just like the most entertaining coach in college basketball to listen talk.
So my fourth pick, I'm staying local. Taking Mick Cronin last year when they got blown out by Houston. Houston ended up beating them. And he went on a tirade saying that he was going to have tryouts at 3 o'clock to see who was going to go to Memphis for the AAC tournament, and that he was going to call Luke Fickell to see if there were football players available. And when the media starts laughing, he stops and goes, what are you laughing at? I'm not laughing. I'm serious. I'm calling football players. It was peak McCronin. It was peak Cincinnati. Anytime that you can like bring in football players, it was the most Mick Cronin thing besides when he took away UCLA's practice gear this year.
All right. So my next pick is, this is tough because I have four really good ones left and I don't want to leave any of them hanging. I'm going to go with from the 1993 NCAA tournament, Bobby Knight talking about the magic lamp, yep. Which is it's. So someone asked him a question of whether they thought Damon Bailey was going to be a better better passer next year or something like that. And Bobby Knight is like, how am I supposed to know that? Can I see into the future? How am I supposed to know that? And he takes his layup off of the table at the dice where he is and just starts rubbing it. Yep. And it looks like he's
I know.
Jerking it off. And he's rubbing it. He's like, I see. And this goes on for like a minute and 30 seconds. And the media is like laughing about it. And it gets kind of awkward. And he's like, I see. That's a shitty question.
For as much as I hate Bobby Knight, that's an all-time interview.
It really
and
is.
It's like an all-time quote.
All right, what's your last one?
Oh man, I got three left that I really want to take. I think I have to take for it's good value here. Jim Boeheim with Jerry McNamara. We wouldn't have won one fucking game after
10.
Right. I'm sorry. 10. We wouldn't have won 10 fucking games after the ACC tournament run. That McNamara had, or no, Big East tournament run.
It was a Big East tournament run.
Big East tournament run. It was just Boeheim to a T. Again, it's hard to replicate cranky Boeheim because I'm not 95 years old. So
it's hard. You have to talk straight into the microphone and like breathe out of your nose into the mic
itself. With one finger up somewhere, like sitting there, like right up. Here.
So disgusted. Boeheim has so many good ones that like fly under the radar. Remember when he got in the fight with the microphone because he kept getting feedback and he got so mad he would just start punching the microphone, throwing it around. Oh, that one's so good too.
All right, so say your last one, then we'll get in some honorable mentions.
Okay. So, well, no, that is my last one. Like I've gone five already.
Okay. So we each have our five. So
yeah. So I have two on. Actually, I have two honorable mentions.
Okay. Yeah,
can you guess one of them? One of them should be pretty obvious.
Jim Boeheim, Greensboro.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Okay.
I only went with the one Boeheim one. But so one of mine was Pat Knight talking about the seniors.
Yeah.
We have the worst group of seniors off the court, on the court, classroom, drugs. I wouldn't be surprised if we lost every game the rest of the season.
He followed his dad.
I'll tell you what about Pat Knight. You say what you will. You want to talk about good storytellers? Pat Knight is the best storyteller in the history of college basketball.
There's got to be something with like Texas Tech because Beard's a good storyteller.
Pat Knight is the best storyteller in the history of college basketball. My last one is I probably should have picked this, but it's Kevin Borseth, who is the Michigan women's coach.
I saw that. Yeah.
He walks out He loses his absolute mind, but he walks out. And the first thing he does is he takes the box score and he slams it down on the little microphone stand that they have. And he comes out there and he slams it down and he goes, "The first time we block out, we get called for a goddamn block out." Proceeds to scream for 2.5 minutes. Lose it. Like, and you have, if you've never seen him, he kind of looks like the picture of the two Amish people from like the Green Acres photo, the guy that has the glasses and he's bald. That's what Kevin Borseth kind of looks like. And imagine him losing his mind, screaming about getting called for a block out. It's hilarious.
So my honorable mentions were every John Calipari Selection Sunday interview every year. Just pick a year because it's the same one. They're always great. The Boeheim Greensboro. And then I had Mike Bray this year after Florida State, where he lost his mind, and he was like, "But no, Leonard Hamilton's a friend of mine." And he just was ranting about how Notre Dame gets screwed because ACC is pissed at them for not being fully in on football. And then it's not necessarily an interview, but it should be listed. Jimmy Patsos going through the imaginary handshake line after the Siena game where there was a fight. And he's just pretending to shake everybody's hands. It's just great Patsos.
Oh, Jimmy Patsos is the absolute best. We should have him on the podcast just to get stories about the time that he used to work as a bartender at Third Editions. People that live in DC, people that went to Georgetown that are listening to this know all about Third Editions. Let's just say that it was it was a place that that would have been a lot of fun if you were a 19-year-old college student.
Yeah. All right, so run through the teams real quick of our five picks each.
So mine are Jim Calhoun times two, Torian Prince rebounding, Dan D'Antoni analytics, and Bob Knight jerking off a lamp. You have John Chaney versus John Calipari, Barry Hinson's my wife, Dennis Clifford crying about
Chipotle,
and Mick Cronin, his tirade about tryouts, and Jim Boeheim, and not 10 fucking games.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure my team wins.
I think I'm favored by like 13.5.
I don't know about that, dude. I think that you're favored by not a dime back.
We'll see. We'll see. If not, I'm gonna kill you.
Anyway, so as always, please leave us 5 stars. Say something nice about us in the reviews of this podcast. The way that we determine which games we're going to do for the Run It Back podcast is based off of the number of reviews and comments we get requesting games. I think right now the lead is Virginia Purdue, the 2019
yeah.
Elite Eight. So unless someone is really desperate and wants to leave a couple of reviews for someone else, then that's going to be the game that we talk about next. So Reeks, it's always a pleasure. After you end up giving me 5 stars and saying something nice about me in the reviews, go find the Fundamentally Sound podcast, rate that, review that, subscribe to that. That's Reeks, the podcast that he hosts. So Reeks, as always, I'll catch up with you on Thursday.
See you later this week.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.